This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli from Broadcasting and Cable Magazine and TVWorthWatching.com, sitting in for Terry Gross. On today's show, we continue the tour through our archives we began last Friday, keyed to the American Film Institute's new list of 100 classic American movies. This new list is divided by genre, awarding the top 10 films in 10 different categories. We start with Martin Scorsese, represented today by two films in two different genres. We'll hear about his gangster epic Goodfellas in a few minutes. But right now, we'll start with the movie the AFI called the number one film in the sports category, 1980's Raging Bull. Martin Scorsese directed it, and Robert De Niro stars as Jake LaMotta, whose boxing career is handled by his brother and manager, played by Joe Pesci. In this scene, Jake worries about his future in the arena.
What's bothering me? My hands.
Your hands?
I got these small hands. I got like little girl's hands.
I got them too. What's the difference?
You know what that means? No matter how big I get, no matter who I fight, no matter what I do, I ain't never gonna fight Joe Louis.
Yeah, that's right. He's a heavyweight, you're a middleweight. We know that.
I ain't never gonna get a chance to fight the best there is. And you know something? I'm better than him. I ain't never gonna get a chance.
Martin Scorsese finally won his first Academy Award for directing The Departed last year. 10 years before that, he was given the AFI's Life Achievement Award. And that same year, in 1997, he appeared on stage with film critic Roger Ebert to talk about his life and career and play clips from his movies. Their conversation was recorded at the Wexner Center for the Arts on the campus of Ohio State University. Ebert has retired from his Sneak Previews TV program for health reasons, but continues to write for the Chicago Sun-Times.
Frequently people will, they know I'm a movie critic, they will discuss the subject matter as if that is what the film is about. Oh, it's a film about boxing?
Yeah, I know.
Or, oh, it's a film about gangsters, or...
Right.
A film is not about its subject, it's about how it's about its subject.
Right, in fact, when...
The subject is neutral, people don't understand that. Whenever anybody makes a statement, I don't like to go to movies about, and then fill in the blank, my response is, anyone who makes that statement is an idiot.
Mm-hmm. No, it's true. It's true.
Don't want to go to bad films about cowboys.
Yeah.
I don't want to go to bad films about boxers.
I know.
I would like to see a good film about a boxer. It might be a more intelligent statement.
Yeah. I mean, when Bob gave me the book originally, it's back in 1974. I never saw a fight scene. I never saw a fight. My father's a big fight fan, but I didn't know anything about boxing, and I wasn't interested in films about boxing. You know. But it took those years for me to go my own way, to come back to understanding really what it was about.
It was about a boxer, but it wasn't about boxing. It was about the boxer.
It was about a man, yeah.
Could you set this up just a little bit by talking about two things? Number one, what people don't always, they observe viscerally, but not necessarily intellectually, how much technique went into the boxing sequences in terms of slow motion and how, and lenses and movement of camera.
What happened with the boxing sequences, once I saw De Niro perform the... nine fights. They had Jake LaMotta and Jimmy Nicholson worked out blocking for nine fight scenes, and he showed him to me in Gleason's gym on 14th Street, and I sat there. I was stunned. In fact, he came over to me. He says, "Are you watching? Because I'm killing myself." I said, "Yeah, I am." And I realized. I said, "Oh boy." I said, because he didn't know. He thought I was like, you know, hanging around not watching it. I'm watching. I realized you can't shoot this. You can't shoot this from my angle. I said, we have to be in there with him, and it's got to be the Wild Bunch. It's got to be, every punch has to be worked out in such a way, or let's say, not every punch, but you have to do it like music. You have to do it like I did some of the musical sequences in New York, New York, where three bars of music was one shot, literally. Not four cameras, and then you cut it together in the editing room. That's selecting, not directing. It's a different thing, you know? But directing is, you know, these four punches, one, two, three, four, camera tracks from left to right, swings around over the shoulder of the guy who's getting hit, and we see a close-up of LaMotta hitting him. And it's got to be an arc, like this, and as fast as the punches. Then on the set, we began to understand that we couldn't even see the punches. They were so fast, we had to go higher speed, 36, 48, 96, that sort of thing, just to see them. In this, you see all the speeds. But what happened was that I drew out every shot for each fight scene. There are nine fight scenes in the film. One, I didn't draw out the shots. So I think it was the second Sugar Ray fight, but I decided they was doing it with long lenses. And we put a bar of fire in front of the lens, so the heat ripples. Mm-hmm. And the most important thing was that the camera never, as much as possible, never goes outside the ring, that you're always in the ring with him. Your sensibility is taken on by his sense of, his vision becomes your sensibility. In other words, what he perceives in the ring. Sometimes I open the ring up. We had a ring that I built special where I made it longer, and sometimes wider. Mm-hmm. And it was like imagine being punched in the head. What you hear and what you perceive, you don't know where you
and
are.
On the
it's all hallucinatory.
You used
breaking glass,
and animal noises.
Animal noises and that sort of thing. Frank Warner did that. He wouldn't tell us after a while what he was using. He said, "I'm not going to tell anybody. You know, that's whatever it is. It's great. It's, you know, that sort of thing. Pulling out the sound, putting in the sound." We even changed speeds during a shot, which now you can do very easily with a button. But then you had to actually do with a non-blimped ARRI, and you had to change the motor and also the left stop with two assistants, that sort of thing. But in any event, what I'm saying is that it was all designed, and they were all designed shot A, B, C, D, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and they all were cut together. And some of the cutting of the fight scenes was the easiest to do because it was all laid out. Mm-hmm. But it did take, we had planned 5.5 weeks of shooting for it. It did take 10 weeks. And it was very specific. And De Niro would have on the side of the camera a very big punching bag, one of those cylinder ones. It looks like a cylinder. And we were ready to yell. We were ready to go for a roll. We'd have the slate ready, you know, and start rolling. And you hear off camera, punching the bag. And then he'd jump into frame, sweating, you know, and then the slate. Mm-hmm. So he came in already heated, bang, ready to go. It wasn't like, wasting any footage. But the physical stamina it took him to sustain 10 weeks of that was amazing. And because he believed in the shots I wanted to get. But what you see here is the final battle, in a way, and the punishment he takes, especially the montage when he gets beaten up by Sugar Ray, is based, in a way, the drawings I made were based on the shower scene from Psycho. And I shot it in that way. There were 39 shots. And it took 10 days just to shoot those shots because there were applications and all kinds of makeup problems. And just to get the angle right, it was like 10 days. And there's even a shot in there Sam Fuller told me about. He said, put the lens in somebody's hand and just swing this way. Right? You'll see it. We even put the camera on the boxing glove, and the glove is in the foreground and comes flying at him this way. It's all in there for like maybe 5 frames, 6 frames, you know.
Let's look.
You know, okay.
We have LaMotta on Square Street holding on. Well, certainly that was one of the most damaging evidences of punching that you have seen in recent years.
Come on! Come on! Come on! Come on! Come on! Come on! What are you standing for?
Robinson, apparently tired, punched with a fairly well and rocked Jake LaMotta right to the heel.
Come on, Ray.
Jake wouldn't
want to
quit. He wanted to go.
Hey, Ray. Level went down, Ray.
He never got me down, right? You hear me? Never got me down. Yeah? See? Look.
And in the 13th round, the hard luck round.
Thank you. It's a killer. Thank you. One thing I forgot to say before it started was that the announcer's voice, that's the actual announcer of the actual fight. The phrases he uses, amazing. No man could take this punishment. That's all real. That's actually as it was happening, you know.
Obviously, the film is in black and white.
Yeah.
It came at a time when you were involved in a battle with Eastman over the fading
color
stock. But apart from that, didn't you believe that this film had to be in black and white?
Yeah, I believe that because an old friend of mine, Gene Kirkwood, walked by my office and said, remember, Sweet Smell of Success. That's a great film by Alexander McKendrick with Burt Lancaster and Tony Curtis. Really sort of based on Walter Winchell. Mm-hmm. And had extraordinary black and white photography of New York and that world, really, James Wong Howe photography. 1950-something, 55, I think, 56, 57. Anyway, I thought of that. And I also knew that there were four or five other boxing films coming out that year. There was The Main Event, Barbra Streisand, and there was Rocky II or Rocky III, I think, and there was a couple of others, and there was even Matilda, the boxing kangaroo in color. I said, think of it, I said, Oz is the only one in black and white. It's got to be different, you know? But the studio was extremely nervous about that, and we had a meeting with David Field and Stephen Bach, I think of UA at my apartment in New York at the time. Because I was living in both places at the time, New York and L.A. And I think it's in that book, Final Cut. He describes the meeting. Interesting about Irwin as a producer, he's really quite good. And he would never let me know the difficulties surrounding the picture as it was working. For example, he told me, he said, guys, you know, David Field, they're very nice guys, actually, David and Stephen. They just want to come up and see you and Bob at the apartment just to talk to you and just, you know, check in on the script and see how things are going. Just, it's a purely personal, it's a hello, goodbye meeting, that's all it is. I read Final Cut, and they're coming up in the elevator thinking they're going to cancel the picture. I said, I didn't know that. This is amazing, you know. And then one of them said something about who cares about, and they were very nice about it, but they wanted to know, I explained the black and white to them, and they went with that. And then they wanted to know why we'd want to make a film about this guy. This guy's like a cockroach. It's in the book. And De Niro just looked at me and said, he's not a cockroach. And they bought that.
Martin Scorsese and Roger Ebert in 1997 discussing Raging Bull. Martin Scorsese also earned a spot on the new AFI list with 1990's Goodfellas, which features our next guest, actor Michael Imperioli. Before Imperioli became Tony Soprano's nephew Christopher on the HBO series The Sopranos, he appeared in Goodfellas as Spider, the kid shot by Joe Pesci. Terry spoke with Michael Imperioli in 2000.
I played a kid who worked in the social club where these wise guys hung out. And, you know, when young kids do that kind of job, they do anything from, like, sweeping up to, you know, going to make food runs or make coffee or bring coffee. In the movie, specifically, you see me serving drinks at a card game. I may go buy them a sandwich if they wanted it, or make them a sandwich for the card game, or, you know, clean up when they're done and do whatever they need. Kind of like a gopher of sorts. That was my character. His name was Spider.
And you get shot.
Yeah, well, that was based on a true story, apparently, from what I understand, that there was a character who was this kid, and one of the guys kind of was getting a little hot under the collar and was fooling around and wanted me to, like, in an old Western, you know, move a little quicker, so he was shooting the ground. He wound up shooting me in the foot, and then in the next scene, he's kind of bothering me and saying, come on, you know, kind of doing the same thing, and I have this huge bandage on my foot, and I get upset and kind of tell him to go, you know, blah, 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 and he gets really upset and winds up killing me. But it's kind of, it happens right in the middle of the movie, and it's, I think, there was no reason really for me to my character to die, and it kind of really showed, that was Joe Pesci who shot my character in the movie, and it was a point in the movie where it really kind of shows he's taken a turn into, like, I guess, depravity, where he's really, it's not about business anymore. It's really, he's just kind of becoming psychotic, where he's just killing whoever he wants to for whatever reason.
Let's hear an excerpt of that scene.
Even though you got that, you could dance, huh? Give us a couple of f***ing steps here, Spider. Bullshit to you. Tell the truth, you're looking for sympathy. Is that it, sweetie?
Why don't you go f*** yourself, Tommy?
Oh, you're right. I couldn't believe what I just heard.
Hey, Spider, here. Yeah, this is for you. Attaboy.
I got respect for this. He's got a lot of f***ing balls. Good for you. Don't take no s*** off nobody. He shoots him in the foot. He tells him to go f*** himself. You're gonna let him get away with that? You're gonna let the punk get away with that? What's the matter? What's the world coming to?
World is coming to. How do you like that?
When the Joe Pesci character is really going over the edge as he's shooting at you, did you feel that Joe Pesci was really doing something transformational in himself in that scene?
Oh, no. I mean, you get into it and you're doing your thing. I mean, I think I was too involved in my thing to, like, be taken out of it and think, wow, he's really going somewhere else. I mean, we were into our own parts and playing it to the hilt. I mean, I never felt he was out of control or that I had to, you know. Although I did get hurt, you know, in the scene when they killed me. In the first take, when I'm getting shot, I hit the ground and I had an actual glass in my hand which shattered. And I sliced two of my fingers open. So I got rushed to a hospital out in Queens, but I had these huge bullet holes and blood all over my chest. And as they rushed me to the hospital, as I went into the hospital, they rushed at me and put me on a stretcher, and I'm trying to explain to them that it was my hand, and they just thought I was delirious and wouldn't listen to anything I was saying and thought, you know, they were going to have to do some kind of, I don't know, trauma surgery or whatever the hell they were going to have to do. And then they finally understood and saw all the rigging for the blood packs and stuff like that, and everybody kind of had a laugh, and it was very funny.
Tell me what it was like to work on a movie with De Niro and Joe Pesci and Scorsese.
You know, I learned a lot watching Robert De Niro. I mean, to be 22 years old and all of a sudden be on the set with Robert De Niro and be an Italian kid from New York and be working with this guy, that was like, I mean, it was really a dream. Those 2 days, I mean, the whole experience of being in that proximity was really a dream. But I watched him a lot, and what I watched from him was economy. He would come to the set, and immediately when he'd be on the set, he wouldn't kind of dissipate his energies. He would be very focused and immediately start to be involved with his props or his, you know, if he was sitting at the card table, when he got to the set, he'd sit down, he'd get his drink and, his prop drink and his props and shuffle the cards or whatever. But I remember watching him on the set, no time was ever wasted, like just kind of sitting around, you know, talking or just, you know, socializing or anything like that. When they cut, he would leave the set. Like he treated the space of the set as something almost sacred, not to be wasted, not to expend superfluous energy on that, like a stage. When an actor does a play, you come onto the stage and you do your part and then you get off the stage. And it seemed he was treating the movie set the same way. Whereas a movie set, you can come on and just like talk and fool around. And some people do that and that's fine. But economy was the thing that I kept seeing that he was doing to keep his energies there. So when the camera's rolling and he's doing a take, you can have your energy be full out.
So you were 22. Did you want to talk to De Niro all about The Godfather and Taxi Driver, or did you want to leave him alone?
No. The first day, Scorsese came up to me and said, the only thing I ask of you is on and off camera, you treat them as their characters, which actually was very freeing because I would have been a nervous, stumbling, fan if I had to say, well, what was it like doing this or that? You know, this actually took the pressure off because the first time I actually was in the room with De Niro, he came and sat down on the set and I went up to him and asked him what he wanted to drink because I was in charge of the drinks. And he kind of just looked at me and then he said, I'll take a shot of scotch and a glass of water. There was no alcohol on the set. It was all props, but it made it very easy because I didn't have to be, you know, he didn't have to be one of the greatest actors of all time, and I'm this, you know, young guy who admires him so much. Although, in essence, that's kind of what our characters were, because he was a very well-respected mobster, and I was someone who looked up to him. But I didn't break that character till I was done with the 2 days, and I said goodbye to him, and he was very kind and offered me words of encouragement, and that was it. But it made it very easy to do that.
Michael Imperioli, speaking to Terry Gross in 2000. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, in for Terry Gross, looking back at more of the movies selected as the best in their genres by the American Film Institute. Which movie won top honors as the best American gangster film? That's easy.
We've known each other many years, but this is the first time you ever came to me for counsel or for help. I can't remember the last time that you invited me to your house for a cup of coffee. Even though my wife is godmother to your only child. But now you come to me and you say, Don Corleone, give me justice. But you don't ask with respect. You don't offer friendship. You don't even think to call me godfather. Instead, you come into my house on the day my daughter's to be married and you ask me to do murder for money.
I ask you for justice.
That is not justice. Your daughter is still alive.
Let her suffer, then. As she suffers. How much shall I pay you?
Buonasera. Buonasera. What have I ever done to make you treat me so disrespectfully? If you'd come to me in friendship, then the scum that ruined your daughter would be suffering this very day. And if by chance an honest man like yourself should make enemies, then he would become my enemies. And then they would fear you.
Mario Puzo is the author of the Godfather novel and co-author of the screenplays of the original movie and its two sequels. Terry Gross asked Mario Puzo about The Godfather, the novel and the movie, when she spoke to him in 1995. He died in 1999.
Describe Don Corleone the way you first envisioned him.
He was sort of very much like you had a brother who was much older than you, who would always protect you, you know, who would always stick up for you. He was somebody who was a protector.
I'm wondering if the character of Don Corleone was changed in your mind when Marlon Brando was cast in the film, and you saw Marlon Brando inhabit the character.
No, I'm the guy that picked Brando.
You did pick Brando.
Oh, sure. I wrote him a letter, and he called me up, and we had a chat, and then I tried to get Paramount to take him, and they refused. And then when the director came on the picture, I talked to the director, Francis Copeland. He managed to talk Paramount into letting Brando play the role.
What did you say in your letter to Marlon Brando when you were inviting him to play the part?
I think it was something like, help, they're going to kill me. They're going to cast, I think it was Danny Thomas as the guy.
Danny Thomas? Wow.
Yeah. Well, he was going to buy Paramount so he could play the role. At that time, Paramount wasn't really worth that much. And Danny Thomas was very rich off television. And I read an item, he was going to buy Paramount Pictures so he could play the Godfather. So that scared me so much, I wrote a letter to Brando. I knew some people who knew him, so, you know, I had an entree. And he gave me very good advice. He said, no studio will hire me. Wait until you get a director, and then talk to the director. And he's quite right. When I talked to the studio, they swore they would never hire Brando.
Why were they so opposed to the idea?
Well, because Brando had built up what to them was a terrible reputation of being a troublemaker, you know, on his Mutiny on a Bounty, we cost him a lot of money, and you know, he was always a rebel. So they didn't want him in their movies. He was too much of a headache, and his movies had been flops.
Now, what were some of the most difficult parts of adapting the novel into the screenplay?
It was a cinch.
Yeah?
Yeah, I mean, it was a cinch because it was the first time I'd ever written a screenplay, so I didn't know what I was doing, you know, it's, and it came out right. And after I had won 2 Academy Awards, you know, for the first 2 Godfathers, I went out and bought a book on screenwriting because I figured I'd better learn, you know, what it's about, because it was sort of off the top of my head. And then the first chapter of the book said, study Godfather 1 as the model of a screenplay. So I was stuck with the book.
I'm wondering, with the dialogue, the characters who really have power are very euphemistic in their language. So they could be saying, they could be giving you the message that they're going to kill you unless you follow their orders, but they'll be saying it in the nicest way. And of course, killing would never be mentioned. Everything's kind of beneath, you know, between the lines, beneath the surface. What made you write the dialogue for these powerful, violent people in that coded way?
Well, it does come from the way the Sicilian mafia operated. In fact, there was a funny story that an Englishman came to live in Sicily, and he got a kidnapping note, because they like to collect the money for kidnapping you before they kidnap you, so they didn't have to go to the bother of kidnapping you. That was the way they operated. But the Sicilian mafia wrote this Englishman such a flowery note that he really didn't understand what they were saying. He had to get an interpreter in. He thought they were paying him some sort of compliment. He didn't realize they wanted like $50,000 off him before they kidnapped him, so to save everybody the trouble of going through the kidnapping. But it was very flowery. Your Eminence, we love you, you know, we'll do anything for you. If you have any trouble, give us a call, you know, and meanwhile, just send us $50,000 and you'll never have any trouble with anybody. But that's how they talk. That's where I got it from. And that horse's head thing was strictly from Sicilian folklore. They nailed the head of your favorite dog to your door as the first warning if you didn't pay the money. They were great believers in collecting money before doing the job.
Mario Puzo, speaking to Terry Gross in 1995. In the American Film Institute's new list of the top 10 animated films, the first 5 movies come from the Walt Disney Studio. Number 6 comes from Pixar, which subsequently was bought by Disney. But when it was an outsider, Pixar released Toy Story in 1995 and rewrote the rules for what you could and couldn't do in animated movies. The director of Toy Story is John Lasseter, who spoke with Terry Gross in 2002.
Let's talk about your first feature, Toy Story. And in this film, you imagine what life is like for the toys in a boy's bedroom when the boy leaves the room. And you go through all the big fears that a toy might have, being replaced, being sold at a yard sale. And most of these toys are old-fashioned toys, like a cowboy doll, a dinosaur, toy soldiers, a little Bo Peep doll. And let me play a scene from very early in the movie where Woody, the cowboy doll, which is voiced by Tom Hanks, is holding a meeting of the toys to prepare for the fact that Andy, the boy who owns these toys, is going to be moving to a new house.
Hello? Check. That better? Great. Everybody hear me? Up on the shelf? Can you hear me? Great. Okay. First item today. Has everyone picked a moving buddy?
What? Moving buddy? You can't be serious.
Well, I didn't know we were supposed to have one already.
But we have to hold hands.
Oh, yeah. You guys think this is a big joke. We've only got 1 week left before the move. I don't want any toys left behind. A moving buddy. If you don't have one, get one. All right, next. Tuesday night's plastic corrosion awareness meeting was, I think, a big success, and we want to thank Mr. Spell for putting that on for us. Thank you, Mr. Spell.
You're welcome.
Okay. One minor note here. Andy's birthday party has been moved to today. Next we have...
What do you mean the party's today?
John Lester, did you come up with the premise for Toy Story?
Well, I came up with it along with my colleagues, Andrew Stanton, Pete Docter, and Joe Rampt. We work in collaboration at Pixar, and we fell in love with this because this idea of toys coming alive. I did a short film called Tin Toy back in 1988, and it was about a little small tin toy that was alive and being chased by this little drooling baby. And from the toy's point of view, it was a horrible monster. And we always loved the idea that toys of toys being alive, we thought there was a lot more you could do with it. One thing we didn't want to do is with our first feature is just do a kind of a with a lot of animated features were being they were kind of like musicals with, you know, a good guy, a bad guy, comic sidekicks, a love interest, and we wanted something different, and we loved the buddy picture genre. You know, the films like Midnight Run, 48 Hours, The Defiant Ones, The Odd Couple. We just love this. One of the reasons why we love this so much was there's tremendous character growth. And I think when you have a character that really grows, there's a lot of emotion there. And that's the thing that we've always strived for in our films.
So the buddies in this are the cowboy doll and the newer, more modern, high-tech right. doll, the battery-operated computer chip.
Right.
Space doll.
In the buddy picture genre, one of the goals is to begin with the two characters being absolutely different, as different as possible.
Mm-hmm.
And so we started thinking about, okay, we have the story, which is an old toy that's a child's favorite. And then at his birthday party, he gets a new toy, and it becomes the new favorite toy. What happens to that old toy? And that's where the essence of the story came from. And so we thought, well, we started looking at new toys, and I kind of looked around just at my own home and realized it was action figures. My sons just love action figures. So we started thinking about it, and I love Star Wars. I'm a big Star Wars nut. And so we thought, what about if it's a space action figure? You know, and so we kind of pulled from every space movie we could think of, as well as NASA and those amazing moon shots when we were growing up in the 60s. You know, with those amazing Apollo astronauts coming out with those clear helmets. They were so cool. And that's why Buzz Lightyear has a pure clear helmet. It's inspired by those NASA astronauts. So we had the new toy first. And then the old toy we were originally thinking of is like a Charlie McCarthy-style ventriloquist dummy. And so Bud Lucky, who's one of the artists that works with us, who grew up in Montana and loves the West, he came to us and said, well, why don't you have a spaceman, why don't you make Woody a cowboy? We thought, that's perfect, because these characters will be as absolutely opposite as possible visually. But on a deeper level, they're very much the same. They're both classic American heroes.
John Lasseter, director of Toy Story, speaking to Terry Gross in 2002. The newest animated film from Pixar, WALL-E, opens today and will feature a review from film critic David Edelstein in a few minutes. But first, let's listen to an interview Terry conducted in 1999 with Rudy Belmer, a film historian who wrote the CD liner notes for the soundtrack to King Kong. That 1933 movie is one of the 10 best fantasy films on the AFI's list.
What are you going to do?
I'll build a raft to float him to the ship. Why, the whole world will pay to see this.
No chains will ever hold that.
We'll give him more than chains. He's always been king of his world, but we'll teach him fear. We're millionaires, boys. I'll share it with all of you. Why, in a few months, it'll be up in lights on Broadway. Kong, the eighth wonder of the world!
Well, the other memorable sounds in King Kong include, of course, Fay Wray's screams and the roar of Kong himself. Let's start with Fay Wray's screams. You know, in the movie, the Carl Denham character, the character who wants to, like, wrangle Kong and bring him back for a nightclub act, He says to the Fay Wray character, he's kind of like teaching her how to scream, and he says, okay, pretend you're screaming for your life, which of course she later has to do. Do you know what kind of advice Fay Wray was given about how she should scream?
Well, the interesting thing is that, of course, if she had done as much screaming when they were shooting this film as it appears to be, she would have been hoarse on the fourth day of shooting. Most of her screams were post-recorded. After the picture finished shooting, they took her into a sound booth, and she did wild screams. And they used those screams, so fortunately she had one major screaming session, which once again was after the film finished shooting.
And of course King Kong has a very memorable roar. What do you know about how that was achieved?
Well, a remarkable man by the name of Murray Spivak, who was the head of the sound department at RKO Radio Pictures at the time, He was confronted with this film, you know, and thought, what can I do? It can't sound like some animal. It has to be a distinctive sound. So he went out and he recorded the roar of a lion and the roar of a tiger, and he was playing things at different speeds and playing them backwards and then combining them. And then even for some of Kong's grunts and things, he recorded himself doing in a little a megaphone type deal. So the sound is a kind of a combination of many things. It sounds like a roar, but it's not a roar that you can identify, which, of course, is what he wanted to do. But by altering the speeds of the recordings and taking two different animals and overlapping them, of course, you can do all kinds of things.
Well, why don't we hear a nice scene with plenty of screams and roars? And this is, I believe, the first time we actually see Kong. Fay Wray is tied at the stake during another one of these ceremonies. And this scene starts with the chief, played by Noble Johnson.
Karatane Kong. Otarave Ramo Kong. Wasaba Sanamaka. Otarave Ramo Kong.
Refused to use a man in a gorilla suit for King Kong, and so they went with, you know, the puppet and stop time animation. Why didn't he want to use a man in a gorilla suit? It certainly would have been a lot easier.
Well, he felt that this had to be something different, and of course there'd always been these men running around in gorilla suits in all kinds of movies that were made in the 20s and early 30s. And you know, that was fine, but he wanted to do something special. And when he saw over at RKO, Willis O'Brien, who was the chief technician, working on some stop-motion material for a picture called Creation, which was never made, and he saw these dinosaurs, he thought, wait a minute, nobody's going to finance me during the Depression to go over to Africa and shoot a gorilla and then bring the gorilla to Komodo and so forth and so forth. When he saw that process at RKO, he thought, wait a minute, this is the way to do King Kong. So he wanted to do it via this stop motion, but to hedge his bet, he also had a huge full-size bust of Kong constructed and a hand and arm of Kong constructed and a foot, so that for some shots, for example, when he's holding Fay Wray in his hand, you've got the hand. When you see an occasional close-up of the head, it's this big, oversized Kong. But he did not want to shoot a man in a gorilla suit. He just drew the line right there.
I've always thought that Kong's size and his, you know, relative size to buildings and people keeps changing throughout the movie.
You're absolutely right on that, Terry. It does keep changing. And this, once again, was people were saying, well, wait a minute, we built him on a scale of 18 inches to a foot, meaning that he'd be 18 feet high. Yet you want to make him, he said, I want to make him, for this scene, I want to make him bigger. I want to make him 24. And they all kind of looked at him like, I want to make him 24 feet. And then on occasion he said, forget the 18, the 24. I want to make him 45. You know? So it does keep changing. But he felt that the concept, when he got to New York, he definitely had to be bigger because of the environment. And, of course, Cooper was right. Cooper had to, you know, do a lot of fighting for things that he believed in. But inevitably, I found through the years, he was right.
Movie historian Rudy Belmer speaking with Terry Gross in 1999. He wrote the liner notes for the CD soundtrack to King Kong.
Well, Denham, the airplane's got him.
Oh, no. It wasn't the airplanes. It was beauty killed the beast. Beauty.
8 years ago, ABC presented a nonfiction documentary series, Hopkins 24/7, which told very intimate, very real stories about the medical staff and patients at Johns Hopkins University Hospital in Baltimore. Tonight, ABC begins televising a sequel series called simply Hopkins, which our TV critic David Bianculli says is just as captivating. He also says that both the series and television have changed in the interim.
How different was TV back in 2000 when producer Terry Wrong presented his original Hopkins 24/7 series? So different that the term reality TV wasn't yet in widespread use. Survivor started that summer on CBS and jump-started the entire genre. But Hopkins 24/7, which peeked over the shoulders of doctors and nurses and gave us an unfiltered look at the way medical personnel work, think, react, and joke, was a different sort of animal. It had some narration, but no music, and it was intentionally, refreshingly adult. It didn't go in for sensationalism, which was why, in the end, it was so sensational. But now it's 2008. Not only has reality TV taken over primetime like crabgrass, but ABC itself has provided a new model for medical drama with its romance-heavy Grey's Anatomy. Hopkins, the sequel to Hopkins 24/7, is televised by ABC on the same night reserved for Grey's Anatomy, and that's no accident. Nor is it an accident that this time around, Hopkins doesn't have any narration at all, but does feature a lot of young doctors and residents, and even includes places for dreamy music and lyrics, just like Grey's Anatomy. So Terry Wrong and company have adapted to the shifting TV landscape, but they haven't sold out. They still hang around the hospital long enough and film enough footage to capture lots of interesting cases and find lots of interesting nonfiction stars. The very first one we meet, in fact, comes out of the blocks running. Or at least walking briskly through the hospital corridors, filmed by a handheld camera just like one of those frantic walk-and-talk scenes from ER. Except that this particular doctor, one of the country's leading brain surgeons, is talking directly to the camera and explaining his fascinating background as an illegal immigrant who jumped the fence as a kid to work the fields. Lou Dobbs, please take note.
20 years ago, I couldn't, not in my dreams, I thought that I was going to be doing this right here, obviously. I was born in a small little border town between the United States and Mexico.
How are you?
And all I wanted to do when I first came to the United States is just to make a little bit of money, send it back to my family, so we could actually put food on our tables.
The only difference now is that I have got an education. I went to Berkeley, Harvard, UCSF, but I'm still the same person. Absolutely nothing has changed. I'm the same crazy son of a gun I was 20 years ago.
That's only one of many really captivating characters, real-life characters, not written ones, we meet in the 6 hours of Hopkins. There's also Brian, a heart and lung surgeon who's separating from his wife as the series begins. And Anne, who works in the ER at Hopkins, and with her West Virginia accent and feisty, unguarded attitude, could slip unnoticed into Grey's Anatomy, ER, or any other TV series seeking a plucky young heroine. You can almost imagine Lou Grant saying to her, "You've got spunk." But she's got honest human emotions, too. When she's driving in bad weather and passes a multi-car pileup on the side of the road, she covers her eyes and keeps on going. That doesn't seem like what someone on TV would do, but it rings as completely, refreshingly honest. Honesty, in fact, is the secret ingredient of Hopkins. Scenes involving Brian, the doctor with marital troubles, are almost too raw. We see his wife hovering nervously during a visit in episode one, and listen to one of their three young daughters as she sobs contemplating the possibility of divorce in episode two. But by episode three, things have taken a turn for the better. Happy endings aren't always part of the mix, though. Some patients we meet get lucky and get that heart or lung transplant in time. Others aren't so fortunate, and we're witness to grief, mistakes, and horrifying decisions about life and death. On occasion, we see these doctors unwinding or filling time by watching TV. A spelling bee here, a Johnny Cash special there. They watch to escape, because most TV isn't brain surgery. But on Hopkins, part of it is. Or a dual lung replacement, where the doctor handles and describes the open-chested lung so casually, providing his own play-by-play, that it's a truly amazing display of confidence. There's usually one moment per hour where, if you're squeamish, you might look away, like the ER doctor on Hopkins passing that car crash. But for the rest of it, I promise you'll be captivated. Real life has better writers than TV does, and the stories are a lot less predictable.
David Bianculli is TV critic for Broadcasting and Cable Magazine and TVWorthWatching.com. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. I'm Terry Gross. We'll close with a song by the gospel group The Dixie Hummingbirds. The lead singer, Ira Tucker, died Tuesday of heart failure. He was 83. He sang with the Hummingbirds since the late 1930s. The group broke through to a pop audience in the 70s when they sang with Paul Simon on his hit Love Me Like a Rock. Here's the Dixie Hummingbirds recording Going On.
Now ever since I've been converted, I've been working.